welcome to The Logstat, the Army's premier podcast on all things sustainment, where we analyze new developments, discuss current trends, and forge the path ahead for the next generation of sustainment soldiers.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Logstat. I'm your host, Captain Garrett Pyle. Today is a very special occasion as we celebrate 250 years of the Quartermaster Corps. Just 2 days ago, we celebrated the Army's 250th birthday on June 14th. It is truly amazing to think about how long it has been. For me, there's 10 generations between myself and my ancestor, Lieutenant Colonel Abraham Cable, who is one of just 17 known family members who have served during the American Revolution. And so much has occurred from June 16, 1775 to today. The Quartermaster Corps, along with the Army, has adopted over time to meet every new challenge that it has faced. It has been the vital piece that has supplied the Army through countless engagements and victories across the globe. To guide us through today's discussion, I have with me today one of the command historians for the United States Army Combined Arms Support Command, CASCOM, in Fort Gregg Adams, Virginia, Mr. Timothy Gil Hull. He has served his position since 2019. He retired in 2015 as a lieutenant colonel and has previously served as battalion commander for the 782nd Brigade Support Battalion, 82nd Airborne Division, and the 71st Student Battalion for the then Army Logistics University. He holds a bachelor's degree in history from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, a master's in history from the University of Richmond, and a master's in military history and science from the U.S. Army School for Advanced Military Studies. I'm so happy to have you here on the show today, sir. Welcome.
Garrett, thank you very much. Very happy to be here to talk about the Quartermaster Corps.
All right, let's get into it. First of all, you have just going over your bio, man, you have a wealth of knowledge from all the studies. I can imagine all the papers you've probably written over from all these years.
Yes, I got it. So I am lucky that at this point, Uncle Sam is literally paying me for what I know. And for all you folks out there with the history degree, myself and my counterpart, Mr. Rubish, are living proof that you can send your kids to college and pay a mortgage with a history degree. So tell mom it's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay. So that's just how important it is to just always remember where we came from, because the history helps, you know, defines where we're going in the future. And I know we're going to get into that today, specifically with the Quartermaster Corps. So I know you're the perfect person to walk us through that.
Absolutely. And as you know, especially with your own involvement as a small group instructor, the Army thinks this history stuff's important, because at every time that we have an example of professional military education, whether in the NCO warrant or officer side, you know, history is part of the POI, it's part of the curriculum. And the higher up you go, the more history you do. When you yourself go to Leavenworth here in a couple of years to get your field grade lobotomy, you're going to have weeks of history. If you are lucky enough to go to the War College, in the future, you will have months of history. So obviously, the higher up you go, the more important it is. And really, history as a discipline is an attempt to try to explain why things are the way they are. And we can use that, you know, today by dissecting a little bit of the Quartermaster Corps.
Yes. So let's kind of get into it. So I know we're going to sit here and talk about the impact the Quartermaster has had on the Army. It's a huge, rich history. It's kind of interesting to say, man, it's been around just as long as the Army's been around, just 2 days after the start of the Army of the Infantry. So I know there's a rich history, there's a ton of innovations that's occurred, especially walking through the Quartermaster Museum here, you get to see just the development of the Corps throughout the years. So to lead us off, how was the Quartermaster Corps founded?
So I say this jokingly, but and you've already talked about it a little bit. So 14 June, Congress appoints General Washington as the commander of the Continental Army and authorized him to recruit those elite company of riflemen. 2 days later, they realize somebody's got to sign for all this. And so on the 16th of June, you have really the birth of the administrative branches. So the Quartermaster Corps and our brothers and sisters down at Fort Jackson as well, AG and Finance, also trace that as their birthday as well. So the first Quartermaster General is a guy named Thomas Mifflin out of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. For a long time, especially here in Petersburg, the former Fort Lee, now Fort Gregg Adams, Mifflin Hall was the home of the Quartermaster Corps.
Okay.
Sit right out where the parking lot is today, but generations of quartermasters going back to the Second World War had their instruction there in Mifflin Hall. the irony of all that is Mifflin was a crappy quartermaster, Jim.
Wow,
he was. Be honest, it bugs me to this day why we've named even the building we're in today. The new CASCOM headquarters is named Mifflin Hall.
Because, I was going to say, I wonder if that's why they tore that building down.
No. And like I said, he's got it. He's named because he's the first. And just because you're the first doesn't mean necessarily that you're the best. If you do a little bit of historical research, you'll see that Mifflin was actually accused of corruption. And then using some health issues. Left Washington, the Army, high and dry just before Valley Forge. And so it takes somebody like Nathaniel Greene, who is technically the third quartermaster general, but he's a very famous Revolution War figure. So Nathaniel Greene, in fact, there's a quote from him that's in the Quartermaster Museum. I'm not sure if you've seen it. He says, "Nobody in history ever remembers a quartermaster," because he knew that this would not necessarily be a position that would bring him great glory. Especially of the battlefield time, type. You know, it takes Greene, as well as this is the same time that von Steuben comes over and starts helping Washington impose military discipline on the Continental Army, so that by the time we come out of Valley Forge, that is a unit, that is an organization that will eventually have multiple battlefield victories, of course, culminating in Yorktown, 1781. That's why we have a United States of America. But it does. Very much. You know, it's funny, as you look at what Washington has to do over the course of the Revolution, in addition to his battlefield leadership, and be honest, he lost more battles than won.
Yes.
Washington, and through his secretary and his aide, Alexander Hamilton, they wrote letters. And what were they writing letters about? They were writing letters to Congress and all sorts of other people, asking for supplies, asking for money. So doing that logistics coordination. So logistics, you know, sustainment as the foundation of how the United States Army, the Continental Army, eventually wins. You know, it technically starts there on the 16th, 2 days afterwards, but, you know, you cannot study the American Revolution without really looking at the stories of our supply challenges over the course of that conflict. And of course, it goes from 1775, technically to 1783 with the Treaty of Paris. But, you know, over that, you know, 8-year period, I mean, logistics is tough. And they have to figure it out. So that's where it starts. And after the war, the position of the quartermaster general, you know, continues, especially after the Constitutional Convention and all that sort of good stuff. And you have the formalization of the United States Army. But the quartermaster general up through Kennedy administration is an extremely powerful person as part of the Army's administrative apparatus. You know, we can talk a little bit more later on, you know, specific quartermaster stuff throughout the various wars. But, you know, the quartermaster corps, the quartermaster commandant, as he or really she is today, is not the same in its scope of duties and responsibilities that it was at the beginning. But that's, you know, all things evolve over time.
Yeah. I mean, one could argue that it was because of the quartermasters we won the Revolution, because, as you just mentioned, like, we lost more battles, mm-hmm, in an open field conflict than we won, but we outlasted them.
We outlasted them, thanks in no small part to the French.
What's
the fact? So I'm reading right now, so Rick Atkinson, great historian and author, he wrote a trilogy called the Liberation Trilogy, which talked about a story of the United States Army. In the first book is called An Army at Dawn, talks about North Africa. Then he has his second book talking about the Italian campaigns. And the third book is the Normandy landings all the way through the end. But he has a new trilogy that's just come out on the Revolutionary War. And I actually got the second book upstairs on my desk. And, you know, and Thomas Mifflin, I said, all right, go to the thing you do with all books, just go to the back, look at the bibliography. Find Thomas Mifflin there on page 294, and they're talking about, he's got, you know, several paragraphs talking about the supply challenges and, of course, you know, the influence of Congress and all this sort of stuff. But I think the important thing for all the listeners to take away when we think about the Quartermaster Corps and where the Quartermaster Corps starts for the United States Army, Like I say, they are an inherent part of the Army and how it does business, and how it thinks about and executes warfare. And, you know, I know at the end we'll have a discussion as how that's shaping, you know, the Army and what we do today here in CASCOM as we reshape formations and trying to figure out how to do this whole LISCO thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
So it kind of gets into our next thing I want to hit on with you is, like, what are some of the major innovations that the Quartermaster Corps has contributed to the Army? Because it's been 250 years, so there's been a lot that's happened. So what are some of those
So I don't personally think of it as much as innovations, but if I think about a phrase that's associated with the Quartermaster Corps, it's somebody's got to do it. And when it comes to somebody's got to do it, a lot of times it is the Quartermaster Corps. One thing that comes to mind for me almost immediately is the topic of mortuary affairs or graves registration. So American Civil War, 1861, 1865, the most lethal conflict in American history, 600,000 casualties in both the North and the South. You know, really, that is far outstrips any of our other battles. You know, and that's for a couple different reasons, the tactics and technology and the lethality of weapon systems and, you know, all that sort of good stuff. But because of the tens of thousands of casualties, you know, that are suffered, you know, the Army realizes it has a large responsibility to care for the dead, you know, in an interim basis initially, but our national cemeteries really start there in the aftermath of the Civil War, and it is the Quartermaster Corps who has that responsibility.
Well, I mean, one wouldn't even think of that. They just think about the Quartermaster Corps, like, knowing that, yes, I know, like, understand, like being in the service and understanding, yes, they fall under them, but if you think about from the outside perspective, it's like, I would never thought mortuary affairs would fall under the quartermaster. And thinking, oh, I'm just thinking beans and bullets, just moving stuff around. Never thought of mortuary affairs being involved with that.
The thing about the Quartermaster Corps, so our brothers and sisters in ordnance can claim that they have the largest number of MOSs, because obviously you need a different MOS to fix a tank versus fixing a rifle or electronic piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. But the Quartermaster Corps definitely has the most diverse portfolio of all the stuff. Because if you even going back to the Revolution, so there initially you had a Quartermaster Corps, and then you actually had a Commissary General who was responsible for food and stores and stuff like that. You know, but eventually, you know, especially well as you get to the First World War and a lot of reforms that are coming to the Army around then. These responsibilities all kind of gel under the Quartermaster Corps. Brothers and sisters in the Transportation Corps.
And
there you go. They are initially part of the Quartermaster Corps, breaking off there in July 1942 as their own separate entity, but pretty much writ large for logistics. If it wasn't having to do directly with maintenance or ammunition, it was the Quartermaster Corps that had responsibility for all of that. And if you look at famous quartermasters throughout history, in fact, another one that comes to mind when we think about the Civil War is Rufus Ingalls. So Rufus Ingalls was the quartermaster general for the Army of the Potomac. So the principal northern formation that's fighting here, you know, in around Petersburg under the command of George Meade, and then obviously guided by Grant, Lieutenant General Grant, for these campaigns. And so, funny story. So Rufus Ingalls from Maine was Grant's West Point roommate when they were cadets there back in the day. But Ingalls is responsible more than anything for helping establish the logistics base at City Point.
Okay.
And so as the 9-month campaign that happened in around Petersburg here to crush the Confederacy, the final bastion that he built. By the time they were doing the final battles in March and April of 1865, you had warehouses and bakeries, and City Point was the largest seaport on the Atlantic coast.
It's funny to think about in today's world.
In today's world,
City Point,
the hundreds of ships, you know, on a daily basis bringing supplies, you know, establishing rail yards that are going directly to frontline positions. And so, you know, the boys who were in the trenches were literally getting fresh bread every day. And especially after the thousands of casualties that Grant and the Army had taken in the Overland Campaign to get down here to Petersburg, they were able to rebuild that army that, again, ultimately was triumphant here.
I mean, think about the
just the morale that is. I mean, you're in the trenches, you're getting fresh bread every day, man.
Oh, yeah.
The huge morale booster you have over your enemy.
Yelling at Johnny Reb over there, hey, man, I got some fresh bread. Come on over. It's okay.
Yeah.
But no, when I think about it in a modern sense, though, because, and it's something we're seeing today, Grant and Ingalls had to basically reconstitute that army, rebuild that army, re-equip that army for another campaign. The modern analog, of course, is what we're looking at in the Russo-Ukraine, where, you know, all the this is all open source stuff, but the Russians are thought to have suffered over 100,000 casualties, the Ukrainians on the order of 60,000. So the army that was there in 2022 is not the same army that both sides have today. Yep. Both have had to recreate that. I mean, when is the last time the United States Army had taken 60,000 casualties? And, you know, how would we, you know, as a nation, much less as a defense community, reconstitute our forces after that? And I know there's smart people both here at CASCOM and up in the building in the Pentagon who are thinking about questions like that right now.
Exactly. I mean, that's this thing that you haven't thought of, especially going through counterinsurgency operations for the last couple decades. Like, that's not something you have to deal with.
And so, you know, so we do for the Captain's Career Course, we take them through our Ordnance Training Support Facility. Amazing facility.
I give a huge shout out to that. I mean, I think that's an amazing facility. I know we talked about beforehand how a lot of stuff's going to be opening up to the, the public now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be awesome because I know for like my dad was field artillery. And I think that would just be awesome for him to see the stuff that's in there because it's just, I don't know. It's beautiful. It's clean. I mean, it's like spotless in there. But the equipment that's in there is just awesome.
And really, we use that. So we're required for the captains to do a instruction on the evolution of combined arms.
Yes.
And so we're able to go there and literally walk through the artifacts and go from the Revolution to World War II era tanks to an Abrams and talk about all that good stuff. Not sure. I forget. I was going down a rabbit hole. But yes.
I just think that's amazing. I do want to kind of use that as just a shout out for things that are here available on Greg Adams. You have the Quartermaster Museum. You have the Women's History Museum.
The Army Women's Museum. Yep.
You just said, I can't remember the name of the...
Ordnance Training.
Ordnance Training.
The Training Support Facility, because that $65 million facility, because Congress in their infinite wisdom would not, and at that point, give money for a museum, but they would give money for a training support facility. And in fact, that's kind of the thing across the Army right now. So at Fort Benning, Fort Moore, Fort Benning, they have one there for the Infantry and Armor School, for the Maneuver School down there. They have one at Novosil for the Aviation Center, and they have one out at Fort Sill for the artillery. And it's a way that the Center for Military History, number one, can preserve those artifacts and bring them together and then use them in, you know, the professional military education of the forces on those installations. But like you said, it's the intent of the chain of command here after. So by the time we hear this podcast, that will be open to the public. There are some one of two in the world artifacts down there.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we definitely encourage folks to come to Fort Greg Adams and explore our museums here.
Okay. Now, those during the week, like what is like the schedule you think going to be for those?
I'm not really sure. I'm told that it will be open at least on weekends, at the very least on Saturday.
Okay.
The biggest thing they're working through right now, and so I am very much just in support of them. I am not directly employed for the museums, but I know that the great folks from our Army Museum Enterprise here are working through all those details, and we'll make sure they get out to the public.
So yeah, definitely be on the lookout for that. So you're gonna have access to be able to check out these facilities. So I know we're having a lot of great discussion today on Quartermaster, but get out and see it in history, like see it in person, be able to see these museums and these artifacts are, because it's one thing for us to have this conversation. It's another thing to actually be able to visually see it. And I know it's some great setups there. So just as a small plug, get out there, check out these museums. The team here has done a fantastic job laying out those museums here. And just so by the time this podcast airs, this should be open to the public. So be able to go out there and check it out. We kind of went through some great instances of Quartermaster history, and having you yourself analyze a ton of history over the years, in your opinion, which Quartermaster unit has the most historic or non-historic heroic story?
I mean, we could have the podcast just on that. This,
no.
Because again, I guess we all have our every historian has their biases. All historians obviously have a time in history which they like studying more than anything else. I grew up on the stories of the Second World War, World War II, especially in Europe. And so when I think about a valorous quartermaster unit, maybe not the most valorous, but a definitely valorous quartermaster unit, I think about the 29th Quartermaster Company as part of the 29th Infantry Division, which landed at Omaha Beach there on the 6th of June. For those of you who don't know, 29th is, even today, a National Guard formation, principally drawn from both here in Virginia and in Maryland. They are the one of the few units, I would say, almost to survive the purging of all things related to the Confederacy throughout the Army. And if you, because their patch uniquely is, it's a circle, but one half is blue and one half is gray, obviously to represent, especially when the unit was first formed for the First World War, that was the first time that you have Maryland and Virginia coming together, you know, with contributing their sons to go off the war effort. But for by the time you get to World War II, again, this is a unit, this will be their first test of combat, landing at Omaha Beach. And it is on D-Day. In fact, I brought with me, just to make sure I give proper credit, the after-action report from the 29th Quartermaster Company. And so it is specifically the 116th Infantry Combat Team, Infantry Regiment, or Infantry Combat Team that lands there. And the quarter, the 29th is represented at that point by 2nd Lieutenant Robert Rosenberg and three enlisted men. They got a quarter-ton truck, and basically as soon as they hit the beach, they go to business because it takes a while for Omaha to be secured. And so they have to, you know, start distributing supplies and obviously helping treat the wounded, evacuate, do all that sort of stuff. And it's over the next couple days that the rest of the company gets there. So when you think about World War II logistics, it's the formations there are sort of kind of like we are, but not so much. And so at the principal maneuver arm is that infantry regiment. So you got an infantry regiment with three battalions. Within the infantry regiment, there is one logistics company, the service company. And the service company commander is actually dual-hatted as the regimental S4 at the same time. So in modern formations, you know, for we have a brigade support battalion, soon to be the light support battalion, but you have that forward support company for each of those maneuver formations. Back then, again, you got that one company that's doing it for everybody. You know, boost that up to division level. Now you don't have a main support battalion or anything, or a sustainment brigade or anything like that. You have a quartermaster company that's supporting, again, the entire division in this case. And you will actually have a division quartermaster, normally a lieutenant colonel, who's going to work for that division G4. But they are responsible for all things quartermaster, which includes fuel, food, mortuary affairs. If you're someplace like the 82nd, you know, the aerial delivery portion of it as well. And so, you know, that particular unit doing their job in one of the most horrific combat experiences in all of Army history, that's really one that comes to mind. I will give a second shout out to the 407th Quartermaster Company, which today the 407th Brigade Support Battalion down in the 2nd Brigade for the 82nd holds the lineage of that. But back in World War II, it's the 407th Airborne Quartermaster Company. They land by glider on the night of 5-6 June there on the outskirts of San Mariglis as the 82nd gets after it and has their, you know, combat experience there in Normandy. But, you know, those two units doing their job, and there's so many, like I said, I'm literally holding a list here of dozens of quartermaster companies that came ashore now at D-Day. For me, one of the most iconic photos when I think about D-Day is not necessarily the one on that day of, you've seen it before, of the LSPs going towards the beach and everybody get off. When I think about D-Day, and when I think about Normandy, I think about the one that's taken 2 days later, where you have the beaches, which are now covered with material and landing craft, and you have that line of soldiers that is walking up, you know, walking off the cliffs to go in there and fight in the hedgerows and all that sort of stuff. That's the Quartermaster Corps at war right there, when you think about it.
I mean, they just, it's amazing, like, just how quickly they established that beachhead and what to supply. I mean, it's like the really taking reception stage and onward movement, RSO and I, to a huge level. And so quickly, they're able to establish the beachhead and just, and I know the picture you're talking about, it's just awesome seeing everything, just seeing things rolled in and just kind of give it a, and if you haven't seen that picture, definitely go look it up or go watch Saving Private Ryan. You can definitely,
there you go.
They show it from that perspective from Hollywood, just to see all the supplies just moving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, by the time this gets broadcast, we'll have just celebrated the 81st anniversary of the Normandy landings there for Operation Neptune.
So that's even unto itself hard to believe it is, but that's been 81 years since then.
Yes.
So.
And again, I would encourage all the listeners out there, I know, so the Army is, I'm not necessarily revisiting, but as we look at the challenge of LISCO, of large-scale combat operations, we start to say, okay, so what are some historical models for us out there where we can get lessons out there? And World War II, especially the campaigns in northern France, very much. You can look at the challenges of contested logistics and all sorts of good stuff like that. So again, if you're in the service, you will be exposed to it through your professional military education, but we always encourage folks to go out there and just dig into it. And if you have a historical emergency, I'm sure that you can reach out through the podcast here and we can provide you with some great recommendations of things you can dig into for yourself.
Oh yes. So one thing I want to look into is, like, I know you're a historian, and it can be difficult to kind of predict the future, but I always look at the seeds of our future can be found in our past. So what lessons learned from the past can impact the future of the Quartermaster Corps as you see it?
Well, I know. So the challenges with, so I'm a big fan is probably not the right word, but a lot of the stuff that we do here at CASCOM is about force design, you know, because it, and honestly, it is in many ways a zero-sum game. You got what you got, but the challenges of sustaining formations is, it's an unescapable burden. And so as we try and look at what the formations should look like, you know, at the battalion, at the brigade, at the division level, at the echelons above division, we kind of look at how we're doing business. So I'll give you this particular, again, so historical analogies are dangerous. I always used to, so I'll say this one very briefly, because this is what how I used to illustrate it. Some people say history repeats itself, but I don't think history doesn't repeat itself. History can rhyme. You can just look at, you know, where we are right now. So Camp Lee, Petersburg in 1919 was one of the epicenters of the global influenza pandemic. And so 1919, you have a global pandemic. It's followed in the 1920s by the Great Depression and global economic collapse. It is followed in the 1930s by the rise of fascism and the Second World War. Just had ourselves not too long ago a global pandemic. And there are economic challenges around the world. And there are bad people out there doing bad things. So they're saying, look, history is repeating itself. No, history's not repeating itself, because in 1919, there's no such things as computers and nuclear weapons and satellites. But that doesn't mean that we can't look back at those time periods and maybe draw some lessons that might be relevant. So let's look at that with, you know, force design in the Second World War. Most of your listeners hopefully have heard of the story of the Red Ball Express.
Yeah.
So the Red Ball Express, of course, Transportation Corps, that's their legacy, pushing fuel to Patton and Third Army and all that sort of good stuff. What most folks don't know is the Red Ball Express was a crisis ad hoc response to a problem that Eisenhower and Patton and all those guys should have seen coming a mile away because of the lack of logistic structure organic to those maneuver formations out there. A lot of it was kept at theater level. By the time they really got moving and out there, the United States Army outran its logistics and had to stop for days, if not a week, for waiting for logistics to catch up. I know here at CASCOM, we are looking hard as we build these new formations. And right now, obviously, the focus is, not obviously, but the focus is on about for the transformation, the TIC, transformation in contact. We're looking at these light divisions, So the 101st, 25th Infantry Division, 10th Mountain. And they are doing rotations back and forth from JRTC, again, trying to figure out what those logistics capabilities look like. And again, it's a zero-sum game. And you really, at the end of the day, want to do it with the least amount forward. But I would just say, as we build these new formations, we got to realize that you'll appreciate that. So Major General retired Jeff Druschel, who was the Chief of Transportation several years ago, a good friend of both me and my wife, he told me once a time, Tim, all logistics is distribution. At the end of the day, it's about getting stuff from one place to another. And it doesn't matter if it's beans or bullets or fuel or you name it. It's all about distribution. And be honest, I think there's a lot of truth to that. So as we look at how we've innovated on distribution over time, you know, and be honest, even from the advent of helicopter warfare, you know, during Vietnam to some of the things that we ended up doing both in Desert Storm and OIF. But now as we look at, and really the thing that has changed everything is the widespread use of drones out there. And so again, we on this side are looking at, all right, so what is the role of drones in distribution? And if we've got, you know, these unmanned systems that can do this, you know, that means now I don't have to put a truck or two, you know, on the road. If I've got, you know, the robots that can push those supplies forward, especially because all of these formations are more dispersed out there on the battlefield. There's an old adage in the Army that says, don't bunch up. You know, because if you are a group of people standing around, they're going to find you out on the battlefield, and every sensor out there is going to try and target. A day does not go by where I don't see on social media, you know, a video of some hapless Russian, you know, that is getting DPI's ICM dropped on them because they're all standing around in a group. And so very much so as we figure out, you know, how do we do distribution on that battlefield? We got the first question we asked ourselves is, well, in past instances, how did we do it? And what were some of the challenges when we did it? Because, you know, the end lesson of the Red Ball Express was, again, we could talk about World War II logistics forever and a day, but World War II logistics in many ways was stovepiped. Everybody was kind of like quartermaster, ordnance trans, all kind of doing their own thing. In fact, in World War II, the Transportation Corps didn't own trucks. It was quartermaster truck companies, but Transportation Corps was still responsible for doing movement control. And they realized at the end of the Red Ball Express is, hey, doesn't it make a little bit more sense that the people who actually are directing the trucks should own the trucks? And that's, you know, that's how eventually it gets there. But bottom line is, as we look at, again, as we look to the past for lessons on how we best shape our formations for the future, just got to realize that, you know, just because we did things a certain way back then, and even if it worked, it isn't necessarily going to be the same here. You know, a lot of historians say that the time period that we're in right now is the interwar period. You know, we are between major conflicts, and there will be another one in our future sometime. But a lot of the best and most important innovation, you know, for future conflicts happens in the interwar period. You know, we figured out, you know, amphibious doctrine and airborne operations, all this sort of stuff before World War II, and then obviously iterated throughout. Right. And so that's what now, again, as the Quartermaster Corps looks at, all right, what do I need to do? How do I need to do things differently, you know, as I approach future warfare? Because again, the Quartermaster Corps has such a diverse portfolio out there. And so if I've got to worry about, you know, if I'm that, you know, I'm that support operations officer in that light support battalion trying to figure out, you know, at the end of the day, how do I push those needed supplies forward to the point of need, you know, on a battlefield where, be honest, everybody is looking for me. Because the other lesson coming out of Ukraine is one of the most targeted formations on the battlefield is logistics. Our quartermasters, you know, kill the loggies, win the war. The Russians, in some cases, have had to move their supply bases 100 miles behind the front lines because, you know, they are targeted more than anything else.
and the berry tree, you need to take out the supplies, you need to take out, as we say, the beans, the bullets, and the infantry, the combat arms, they have nothing to fight with.
Yep.
So that is very true on, especially as we get in this new day and age with the way targeting is, the heavy use of artillery, and with drones, is like, that's something we really need to take into a good lesson learned for the quartermaster corps. I know, of course, we're developing here large-scale combat operations. How do we do distribution operations? How do we conduct these? Because we're not all grouped up. There is no more one giant brigade support area anymore, because that's just one giant target waiting to happen. And yet we have to be dispersed, be able to conduct these operations while being dispersed.
Absolutely. And to be honest, again, that puts the burden on the technical expertise of those quartermaster corps soldiers out there in the MOSs. You know, for me, I really think about, the supply support activity. So the SSA, where all the parts and everything is in. So how does the SSA operate on that modern battlefield? Where is it? Is it broken down a couple parts? How do you push the stuff forward to the point of need? That is, you know, as we, it's funny when you mentioned a little bit earlier, but, you know, so my particular experience, you know, in deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, be honest, that experience is irrelevant, you know, in the face of the changes that, you know, drones and other technologies have to modern warfare. Because be honest, when I roll off a convoy, you know, into scenic Camp Spiker, and I looked at that, you know, $1 million dining facility, it's like, hey, do I want to have steak and lobster or steak and lobster today? No more steak and lobster. Because, you know, if we rolled into giant facilities like that, again, that is what is being targeted more than anything else. And so, you know, the lessons that we're teaching to the young soldiers here, to the 92 Alpha, the 92 Yankees, to our Dirty Foxes, 92 Foxes, the 92 Whiskies, they're learning different things about how they're going to have to operate on the battlefield. Again, where they are, in many cases, the subject matter expert, you know, at the forward echelon.
And I think to kind of close us out here today, from your years of experience, your wealth of knowledge, what advice do you have for the sustainment community?
When I was branched initially, so I would show my age, I was branched in 1992 as a quartermaster officer. And be honest, it was like number 10 on my list. I did not want to be a quartermaster officer. But then I came here for my basic course, and I realized that everybody in the brigade is going to die if you don't do your job. That logistics, logisticians, you know, quartermasters, you know, they deal with every branch. There is a quartermaster in every unit of the United States Army. Because again, at the end of the day, somebody's got to sign. There's got to be a supply sergeant there. So it doesn't matter if it's Delta Force to the 1st Armored Division, quartermasters are everywhere. And, you know, I think quartermasters and logisticians writ large, sustainers, do best when they are up there with them. You know, especially if you look at, again, it's amazing how the wars affect culture. So how were quartermaster soldiers depicted in popular media after World War II? It was, you know, the greedy supply sergeant who's not giving you your stuff out there. Great movie called Kelly's Heroes from 1970, where Don Rickles plays the supply sergeant, and he isn't necessarily portrayed as a glorious martial figure there. But again, I've seen it over the course of my career. You know, quartermasters do best for their unit when they are there in the thick of it. So my counsel to logisticians out there, no matter where you are, you know, go where your combat arms brothers and sisters are. You need to be there with them in the suck. You know, you gotta, in many ways, because they're gonna say, well, I'm a carnivore and you're just a herbivore. Well, you don't want to be a herbivore. You got to be an omnivore, you know, and you got to get there and you got to keep up. And be honest, you're proving yourself and proving the relevance of your unit every day. Because the other not necessarily funny thing that has come out of the most recent conflict in Russia and Ukraine is it's amazing how all these folks came up online and said, I want to apologize to every logistician I ever degraded. because I see how important that stuff is. The reason the Russians initially were getting their ass kicked is because they weren't doing good logistics. And the Ukrainians were targeting deliberately their logistics, fuel trucks, and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, the lessons for us, for sustainers, as we move forward into the, you know, third and fourth decade of the 21st century here, is, you know, we just need to make sure that, you know, that we are there at the point of need. Because if we want to support victory, you know, as the quartermaster motto, you know, we've got to be there to make sure it happens.
Awesome. Well, just I truly appreciate, thank you, sir, for coming in today. This has just been an amazing conversation. I know we could sit here for hours, maybe even probably days, just go over this, the true detailed history of the Quartermaster Corps. There's just so much, and I know we barely scratched the surface on the impacts, the history behind it, just the all the contributions that the Quartermaster Corps has. And once again, I highly implore you, if you're near Fort Gregg Adams, get out, be sure to visit the Quartermaster Museum as well as the others here. They'll be open to the public, so make sure you get out there, check them out. So everything we just talked about, see it for yourself. Be able to go out there and see it. And if you want a more in-depth look at the history of the Quartermaster Corps, then be on the lookout for his article titled The Quartermaster Corps at 250, Still Support Victory. It's out on the Live Departure website, and it will be featured in the summer edition of the Army Sustainment Professional Bulletin. And also, sir, of course, before we close out, if someone has any questions or anything, where's a good way they can be able to reach out to you?
Absolutely. So there's not very many Gil Hools out there on the web. Definitely feel free to send me and find me on the Enterprise email and find me. If you are on Facebook or other social media, I know the Logistics Officers website administered by Colonel Joe Parker and other great folks out there. That's another great place where you can put questions or information. Yeah. But again, no issues if you want to reach out to me directly, especially if you've got a question on your unit or the history of the Quartermaster Corps.
Awesome. Well, that is all we have today, folks. Thank you so much, sir, once again, for coming in. I hope you all enjoyed our discussions. Definitely be on the lookout for more episodes coming soon on our weekly schedule, as we are now every week. So that's double the conversation and an immense increase in our lethality. As always, sustainment leaders start here. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Logstat. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please share this episode across your formation and leave us a review. If you have a topic you like here discussed, then please reach out to us at armysustainment@army.mil or directly to me on Global at garrett.h.pyle. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn at Army Sustainment. We'll see you next time. Sustainment leaders start here.